I'm David Lazarus, and this is the Marketplace Weekend Podcast for the weekend of June 26th, 2015. It's a tough world out there, but it's also a world of opportunity. And that's what we're talking about in today's show, opportunities, and how you can make the most of your eye of the tiger. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. It's the show where the economy collides with real life. I'm David Lazarus from the LA Times, in for Lizzie O'Leary. This week, job opportunities, future opportunities, even missed opportunities. Make sure to visit our website, marketplaceweekend.org. Reach out to us on Twitter. We're at MarketplaceWKND. All right, opportunity's been knocking long enough. Let's let it in. To start the show today, some economics. A big trade deal between the U.S. and a group of Asian nations is looking pretty much like a slam dunk. That's thanks to passage of some key legislation this week. It's called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP for short, and it's supposed to create some big opportunities. But who's the real winner here? To help me understand that, I'm joined by Patty Hirsch. He's our explainer-in-chief here at Marketplace. Hello, Patty.
Hello, David.
So, Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP for short.
TPP for short.
Been in the news a lot, but it's kind of policy wonky, yet yeah. We should all care about this.
It's the most important deal you've never heard of.
Tell us more.
Well, you've never heard of it because nobody is allowed to read about it. They're putting this plan together to do a single trade deal with a number of Asian nations, not including China, but most importantly, Japan. And while they're doing this deal, where they're actually doing all this negotiating with all these other countries, nobody's actually allowed to know anything. It's all done in secret, so nobody knows what's going on. Even members of Congress can only go into like a locked room and read the papers and come out. They're not allowed to take any photocopies or anything with it. It's all very, very secret.
What's amazing is so-called TPP has been a huge ongoing story throughout Asia. In fact, the Japanese press has been obsessed with this trade deal. Mm. The American public virtually unaware of what's happening. And yet, I mean, picture in your head a map of the Pacific and the so-called Ring of Fire and all the nations that are around there. You link up all of those economies, and I believe we're talking about 12 of them. Suddenly you're looking at a very, very important trade bloc. Now, this has big ramifications, not just for the U.S., but specifically for the West.
There's a lot of countries involved here, but we already have trade deals with a lot of these countries. What this is doing is kind of ironing out, it's kind of flattening the playing field across the region. And of course, the Japanese are making the most noise about this because it's a very big deal for them. And actually, they're the biggest partner that we're talking about dealing with here. What we have in place right now, these things called tariffs, which are basically taxes on goods you want to sell into a country. And the Japanese have got very high tariffs on things like rice and autos. So if we want to sell rice and cars into Japan, then companies that want to do that have to pay very high taxes on those goods that they want to sell. Well, likewise, in the U.S., if you want to sell sugar into the U.S., or if you want to sell, in Japan's case, if you want to sell trucks into the U.S., you have to pay these very high taxes. So what everyone's hoping will happen, this deal will actually lower these tariffs.
Now, is this a slap in the face of China? Because as you noted, they're not a part of this.
You know, China, nobody's really sure what the heck's going on with China right now. I mean, this is a developing country, let's not forget. They are, however, the big market. And so what the government is hoping, President Obama and all of the people who are involved in this are hoping, is that this trade deal is going to set the tone for the negotiations with China when they come up.
So where are the opportunities here? Is it in investing in companies that are focused on the Pacific region?
Yes. You know, opportunity is really knocking only on the doors of American corporations, as far as we're concerned, right? American companies that want to sell into these countries, like I say, they have to pay tax on the stuff that they want to sell in there. So presumably, if those tariffs are lowered, it means that they're going to be able to sell more into those economies, which means they're going to make more money. So yes, this is a big investment play for us. It's great for American companies. Whether or not it's going to be that great for American workers is the question. And that's why there's been a lot of opposition to the TPP and why you've heard a lot of sort of furore about it recently, not only because of the secrecy, but also because of the fact that people are worried that even if American companies do have access to these new markets, it's not actually going to benefit American workers that much. For one thing, you know, take shoe companies, for example. One of the tariffs that they're hoping that will be lowered for exporting into these Asian markets will be, you know, tariffs on shoes. But most of these shoes that are made or that are produced by American companies are not made in America. So any job gains aren't going to be made necessarily in the manufacturing facilities in America because there aren't any. They're going to be made in manufacturing facilities in other countries. And also, because it's going to be easier for those foreign companies to import their goods or export their goods into the United States, then it means that those goods may be cheaper. That's going to put pressure on American industry, and it may mean that we see jobs being lost in those American industries, which is not going to be good news for American workers either.
Because U.S. labor costs are higher, does that mean that even though trade barriers might come down, we'll still be at a disadvantage trying to sell into these other marketplaces?
Quite possibly, yes.
Then what is the upside for the United States in being a leader in promoting TPP?
Well, it's great for the shareholder economy. Around 50% of Americans are invested in the stock market. So if American companies are going to do better and they're going to grow, then, you know, people's stock is going to go up and, you know, people's 401ks are going to look better. So that's going to be the good play. Also, in the future, we're hoping that if American companies are able to do more business in these economies, and because of the lowering of tariffs, then presumably those businesses are going to grow. And if they grow, then it should mean more jobs for Americans. However, a lot of people, a lot of Democrats in particular, point to previous trade deals and say, well, that hasn't happened in the past. Why would it happen this time?
Patty Hirsch, thank you very much for joining us.
That's my pleasure.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. When it comes to investing, there are opportunities and there are missed opportunities. Here to talk about some of the biggest missed opportunities of our times is Gabriel Wisdom. He's president of American Money Management in San Diego, California. Hiya, Gabriel.
Hello, David.
You know, when it comes to opportunities, I remember that when Google first went public at like $84 a share, I wrote a column saying, $84, that's crazy for a company that's just one algorithm away from being beaten by somebody else. Boy, do I feel stupid now.
Everybody has that feeling, and usually the most attractive stocks are the ones that look pricey. Take Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway. I remember in 1994-95, it was around $1,200 a share. Well, it's over $200,000 per share today. Priceline.com traded for a long time over $100 a share. It's a lot more than that today, more than 10 times.
I remember the scene in Forrest Gump where Forrest finds out that all his money has been invested in Apple. He doesn't know what that means, but clearly he's never going to have to worry about money for the rest of his life. I remember when Apple, you know, had like 3% of the computer market and was not looked at as a going concern. Now it's the most valuable company in the entire country.
Yeah, that's a great movie. And, you know, what happens is they sell the Bubba Gump shrimp boat, and Lieutenant Dan takes the proceeds and puts it all in what Forrest Gump thinks is a fruit company. But Apple has been a fallen angel and a rising star half a dozen times since it went public. And this goes back to December 1980 at $22 per share. If you just hung in there, $5,000 would be worth $1.6 million today.
Ooh, the road not taken right there. So how does an individual investor, you know, a small fry, look at all of these potential opportunities and figure out which ones are the real deal and which ones are barracudas waiting to bite you in the booty?
Well, you know, if you search the internet like a lot of us do for ideas in investing, you're going to find a lot of them, and they all have compelling headlines. 12 stocks a young Warren Buffett would buy from MarketWatch. 15 best stocks for the next 15 years, Kiplinger. Early signals of home run stocks from Zacks Research. Bottom line is the great companies usually have large personal stakes with the founders. They have financial statements that are easy to read, not complicated. There's little or no debt. The price-to-earnings ratios undershoot the growth rates of the company. and they're in a dominant position in a profitable niche. If you just you hold out for those, you've got that slow pitch down the middle.
Yeah, the problem here is that a lot of people want to hit that home run off of that slow pitch, which these days often means social media or tech. You know, everybody wants a piece of the next Facebook. On the other hand, you look at those valuations and it's all about growth, and there might not even be a single cent of profit.
Some of the great investments over the last 15, 20, 50 years have been in very ordinary companies. And in fact, the all-time record performer, according to research from Ken Fisher at Forbes, is our very first railroad, Kansas City Southern, symbol KSU. A $1,000 stake in Kansas City over the last 65 years would be worth $42 million today. That's remarkable, but it speaks to just paying little or no attention to crises, wars, problems, calamities as they come along and just hanging on.
Well, here's the other side of that, and that is I'm thinking about going long into tulips.
Well, that there was a time. How about Bitcoin? You know, Bitcoin was trading at a half a penny per Bitcoin in 2009. There was one grad student who discovered Bitcoin writing his thesis on encryption. He put it away in the digital wallet, forgot about it, read about it in 2013, opened up his wallet and found that his $27 investment in Bitcoin was worth $886,000.
Yeah, but it's funny money. I mean, I look at Bitcoin and I think the same thing I think about investing in gold, and that is, I don't know how to value this thing. I just don't understand its valuation. And then I look at Bitcoin and I think, are you kidding me? It's not backed by any government. It's not backed by the full faith and credit of anybody. It's just how much we think it's worth. That doesn't seem like a very smart investment.
I put it in the same category as baseball cards and pet rocks.
Yeah, word to the wise here. Go and try and trade pet rocks for anything.
That's right.
And how do you feel about my garage full of Beanie Babies?
You know, those, if over the long haul, they probably go up because people will wonder, what were we thinking?
What were we thinking? Gabriel Wisdom is the president of American Money Management. Gabriel, thank you so much.
Thank you, David.
Listening to Marketplace Weekend. I'm David Lazarus, in for Lizzie O'Leary. We're talking about opportunities, and we'll get back into that. First, let's look at some of the biggest numbers in the news this week. Every day, Marketplace's By the Numbers blog tracks those figures and serves them up at marketplace.org. Here are digital producers Tony Wagner and Tobin Lowe. Tony?
Thanks, David. Our first number,
6-3,
is how the Supreme Court voted in their decision to uphold federal subsidies for health insurance.
That means it's pretty likely the Affordable Care Act will stick around after President Obama leaves office.
89%.
That's the portion of packaged foods found to be mislabeled at Whole Foods stores in New York City.
The city's Department of Consumer Affairs says it's one of the worst cases of overcharging they've seen.
369,000.
Is how many copies of To Kill a Mockingbird publisher HarperCollins shipped this spring.
Compare that to 59,000 shipped during the same time last year.
The reason for the sudden increase in sales?
With news of a new book, folks are getting more interested in all things Harper Lee. And all things Harper Lee is pretty much just To Kill a Mockingbird.
This week, Ford announced some big plans, one of which is to become a bit more like Uber. To tell us a little more about that, we're joined by Molly Wood. She's Marketplace's senior tech correspondent. Hiya, Molly.
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm good. I don't get it. Wait a minute. Ford makes cars. That's what they've been doing for an awfully long time. And now they're talking about some kind of Uber activity?
Yeah, you know, Ford has been making some really interesting moves. I think that they are a fascinating company to be watching right now because they are very forward-looking. They're investing heavily in technology and starting to just be a little more creative, I guess, in how they consider the company and how they are going to be moving forward. I actually had the chance to talk to the CEO, Mark Fields, pretty recently, and I think that he describes it best. I'm gonna let him describe it, and then we can talk about it a little further how they're thinking about themselves.
This is our message to everyone, and this is the message around thinking not only as a car and truck company, and we're going to stay very, very focused on that, but also thinking as a mobility company. And as any company, you need to have 1 foot in today and then 1 foot in the future.
All right, so this guy's obviously recognizing opportunities out there, but I wouldn't have thought mobility company was right. The opportunity he would search for.
Right. I think that's such an interesting way to phrase it. They've been calling themselves this for a while now, a mobility company, which really, you know, encompasses the possibility that in the future there could be fewer cars on the road. There have been some studies that say once we get to fully autonomous cars, self-driving cars, we won't need as many. We'll only need about a third because we'll have a fleet of automated cars that can just drive around and pick people up. So maybe individual car ownership won't be as necessary, and it's already becoming a little less important to millennials and in big cities where there's just not that kind of space. So Ford is preparing for a future where they have to provide all kinds of options, and one of those might be an Uber-style shared fleet of cars.
Which is interesting because they're going to pre-screen all the participants. They're going to make sure that you are financing the thing through Ford. And then potentially they're going to have a lot of other customers right there at their doorstep who are going to be participating in the program.
Yeah, it's very bold. I mean, it really, and I could see it being appealing for people. You know, we're sort of increasingly you have this generation of people who don't think of ownership in the same way. They think of utility. And that might be a streaming music subscription. That might be never needing to own a DVD again because every movie is digital. And that sort of mentality might extend all the way to a car. You don't need it all the time. It's a little bit wasteful when I think about how much time my car spends sitting in my garage when it could be out in the use of someone else.
I think it's very interesting that a car maker would recognize opportunity in the idea that people are driving less.
I do too. And I actually think that that is somewhat impressive. I think it's rare for, you know, Mark Fields says it very matter-of-factly that any good company should have a foot in today and a foot in the future. But I actually think a lot of companies have a history of being planted firmly in the past and not wanting to recognize some of these really major changes. Now, that's not to say that Ford is going to succeed, right? They might be putting their efforts in the wrong place. They might not identify the right technologies. But the fact that they are thinking and acting so strategically to create new business models that have increasingly little to do with their original business model, I think is actually pretty impressive.
Is Ford also aware of the potential competition coming from the likes of Google?
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting to hear almost all car makers, and particularly Ford, talk about how their competition now isn't just GM or Volkswagen. It's Uber, like you said, it's Tesla, and it's absolutely Google. I mean, Google, for its part, is working on efforts to basically get as many human drivers off the road as soon as possible.
So it sounds as though like Fields looks at Silicon Valley and he sees that as potentially the new Detroit. I mean, not to put too fine a point on it.
Right.
In a sense, does he see the next generation of cars as being computers on wheels?
I think he does. Absolutely. You know, he talks a lot about how the lines of code, the amount of computerization is more than anybody ever would have imagined it to be. And when they come to Silicon Valley, you know, they have this research and development lab in Silicon Valley. They want it to be the biggest of any car maker in the Valley, and they're growing it tremendously. And he wants that sort of Detroit and Silicon Valley essence to come together. It's not so much that Silicon Valley will become the new Detroit, it's that they need each other to survive, and maybe more that Detroit needs Silicon Valley to survive.
Yeah, what you're saying is next time my car doesn't start, I'll just have to press Control-Alt-Delete to fix it.
They're getting more complicated. I think we've seen that for a while.
Molly Wood is Marketplace's senior tech correspondent. Molly, thank you as always for joining us.
My pleasure.
When it comes to opportunities, job opportunities have to rank high on the list. And with the job market finally improving, the opportunities are growing. So how do you approach something like that if you're a job hunter? Or how do you improve your current gig if you're not going anywhere? To answer those questions, we turn to Hallie Crawford. She's a career coach based in Atlanta. Hiya, Hallie.
Hi, thanks for having me today.
Now, thanks for joining us. And these are interesting times. The unemployment rate going down. We're seeing more and more employers bringing more people on as the economy improves. And that's a big turnaround from the recession because it means there might indeed be some greener grass on the other side of the fence finally.
I know. It's so exciting because for so many years there, people were just fearful. And, you know, we would have clients call us and say, well, I'd really like to make a move, but I just feel like I should be grateful I have a job at all. And they weren't willing to make a move. And now we're seeing people more optimistic and more willing to take a stand for what they want.
So what should a job hunter keep in mind in an environment like this? That it's possible to trade up or that any move you're going to make is maybe going to be a sideways move?
Well, it could be either. So here's what I always tell people is you can trade up and always focus on, it's kind of like go for the gold, you know, as much as you can. You may have to compromise on certain things. But in these times, people have to compromise a little bit less. What I tell people is even if, let's say, you have to make a lateral move, in some cases people do, as long as it's a step in the right direction towards what you want long term, that's all that matters. People who are transitioning, say, from one industry to another and trying to go for that ideal career for them, they are more able to do that now, again, with the improving economy.
I think in recent years, many people would have been shy about trying to bargain up their salary from a potential new employer to come back and say, well, all right, I like your offer, but can you be a little more aggressive now?
Yes, I think that you can. You do need to do your homework and be realistic. So make sure you do your research, you understand, you know, what the market can bear, especially in your industry and in your location. But I think you can be more aggressive and ask for just a little bit more than you used to be able to. Absolutely.
Well, let's talk about people now who aren't looking for another gig, but would like to make their current job a bit better. We've seen in recent years productivity numbers were very high, which means in part that employers were getting more bang for the buck out of their existing workforce, essentially making them work harder and not paying them anymore.
If you right.
If you want to turn that around, do you have any leverage at this point? Is there a way to finally say, hey, I understand things were tough lately, but it's time to show me a little bit of love?
Yes, I think that you can. I mean, think about it this way. It's a lot harder to go out there, find a new employee, train them, et cetera, especially if you've been a hard worker and productive and successful for them in the past. So you absolutely do have leverage. And I always tell people there's kind of a mental game to this, looking in your own backyard, so to speak. People in some ways are still afraid to ask for, you know, that additional opportunity that they want to have. Or some of us discount and say they just assume that it's not going to happen. But you absolutely can. I always encourage people to take more charge of their career and be proactive about this and always ask. People are afraid. Sometimes they assume it won't happen. And honestly, a lot of us, and I can say this because I've done it before too, is they get, frankly, kind of lazy or complacent. And we can't do that.
Is there anything to the idea that some managers will offer you, or rather, will give you a raise if you ask, but if you're sitting around waiting for it to be offered, it's not going to happen?
Exactly. That's the number one problem I see is people tend to expect these things to be handed to them, whether it's salary or whether it's that next opportunity or additional responsibility that you want to have that will take you to the next level in your career. They assume that it's just going to be handed to them. We cannot assume that at all, regardless of the economy. Even though it's better, we still have to ask for what we want and be very proactive about it. Check in with yourself every 6 months. Am I headed in the right direction? What is the next step for my career?
Well, it sounds like you're saying there's opportunities out there, but you also have to make your own opportunities.
You do. I have a problem sometimes when clients call us and they say, well, you know, my job isn't working, and they're frustrated. And I understand that. And in some cases, they're not in the right fit. But too often, they haven't made the job into what they want it to be. They haven't asked the right questions, asked for what they wanted. I have a client who's in Washington State. She's been at her company for 13 years. And frankly, she's bored. She's asked her boss twice this year for additional responsibility and opportunity. Nothing's happened. Last week, she went over his head and talked to her boss's boss, the person who originally hired her, and he is now looking to create a brand new position for her because she made the case, she explained what she wanted, she just got her MBA, and he's going to get back with her in a month to find out and tell her if they can do this.
Boy, talk about stepping up your game, huh?
Yeah, no kidding. And it's scary. I mean, we had to talk about it for an hour for her to feel comfortable, for her to frame her case, discuss, you know, how she wanted to present it. But she did it. And look what happened. And look, even this was kind of her last step for her, is if they don't follow up with this, then she will go somewhere else. But wouldn't it be wonderful if they did?
Note to self, ask Marketplace for raise. Okay, got that down there.
Exactly.
Hallie Crawford is a career coach based in Atlanta. Hallie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Milton Berle once said, if opportunity doesn't knock, build a door. Or in today's world, you can program one.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology. This is Tech in Real Life.
We're joined by Ben Johnson. He's the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Hiya, Ben.
Hi, David.
All right, I'm looking at my own kid here. He just finished a whole week of computer camp where he learned Java. And I'm thinking,
Yes. Okay,
this kid is skilled now and I can just retire a happy man.
Oh, if it were only that simple, if only you could offload all of your, you know, need to earn to your child who knows Java now. It's not that simple, David, but coding does actually represent a really interesting opportunity. It's something that people are talking about a lot now. It is like a lot of skills. It's not as easy to learn as some might have you believe. It's not going to make you a bazillionaire just by learning it, but it does bring you new opportunities for employment or even just understanding the world that we live in now. You know, it really depends on how you go at it.
Let's define this thing. When we talk about computer code, it sounds very scary. In fact, there's a lot of dialects of a similar language.
Yeah, coding is actually a general word that is used to describe languages plural, right? There are a ton of coding languages out there, and they all do different things. You got your Python, you got your Ruby, your C++, and on and on. And choosing a kind of code really depends on what you want to do. So do you want to learn how to make hardware work? Do you want to develop a mobile app or build websites? All of these things require that you understand different languages. So it's helpful to have an idea what you want to do before you dive in. But it's also important to dive in and to just play with stuff. The beauty of computers is that they're really hard to break. And most people who are really successful at coding have learned by doing.
So let's talk about how you get into this kind of thing. I mean, not everyone's going to go to computer camp, but if you want to get the hang of this thing, can you read a book? Do you have to sit around with some Yoda-like figure who's going to teach it to you?
If only you could sit with Yoda and have him teach you how to run Ruby on Rails or something. There are a lot of different ways you can go at this, David. I would actually recommend, if you're someone who doesn't know anything about coding and you're kind of curious about it, I would start small and start free. You can do something as simple as going online and searching YouTube videos about learning how to code. There are trade groups and schools that offer programming. They can cost a lot of money, so they can cost up to $1,600, for instance, for a six-week program. But a lot of these companies also offer scholarships. So Code Academy is an interesting company trying to build coding into education. There's General Assembly, which is an organization that teaches a lot of technology and design skills. And they have a new program called Women on the Rise that specifically tries to get women into coding. There's also this organization, Girls Who Code. It's supported by Microsoft, AT&T, Google, and others. It tries to get girls into coding at an early age. There are lots of opportunities of all kinds, but like I said, I would recommend just kind of like poking around online and seeing what you find and seeing if any of it piques your interest and then sort of following your nose that way.
In other words, do or don't do. There is no try.
That's exactly
from
right.
Downtown.
There
he scores.
Is no try.
All right. So
there's only code or not code.
Coding, you will. Okay. So let's talk about it. You learn it. You get the hang of it. Whatever
sure.
language you pick, and then yep. what do you do?
Code is a fundamental part of almost every industry now, David. So whatever industry you might want to work in, there are either opportunities for coding that are really obvious or ways in which you might create an opportunity with coding in the industry you want to work in. Wherever you are, there are probably opportunities for you. Again, I would just say you want to be sure that you're careful about this. There's a lot of buzz about coding. It's not a magical skill that immediately solves all your career challenges, right? It's something that allows you to explore new fields. It maybe opens new doors. But, you know, you just kind of want to be careful and make sure you're not emptying your wallet, so to speak, to get a skill that you would assume is going to immediately get you a job and a bunch of new opportunities.
And you too can be a Jedi.
Hopefully.
Hopefully. Ben Johnson's the host of Marketplace Tech and, as always, our guide to tech in real life. Ben, you are a Jedi. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me, sir.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. I'm David Lazarus from the LA Times, in for Lizzie O'Leary. When you think of the 1950s, you might think of this.
The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet, starring the entire Nelson family, Ozzie, Harriet, David, and Ricky.
Unending opportunity, limitless optimism. Were things really that rosy back then? And what about now? Is America still an economic promised land? Here to talk about that is Peter Capelli. He's a professor of management at the Wharton School. Welcome to Marketplace Weekend.
Thank you.
First, let's do the reality check. When we look back at the 1950s, was it in fact two chickens in every pot and everything was coming up bread and roses?
Well, I'm not sure that there were two chickens in every pot yet, but things were coming up because remember we had just come through a war with rationing of goods and services. It was difficult to get certain products. And of course, a lot of people were in the war and they came home. They're pretty happy not to be shot at. So things were looking pretty good. And for the U.S. economy, all our competitors had pretty much been wiped out by World War II. The only other industrial country that was really left unaffected was Sweden. So, you know, we had the world markets more or less to ourselves.
And at the same time, you had that huge returning workforce of the servicemen and women and the GI Bill, which allowed many of them to re-enter the workforce with new skills.
Yes, that's right. And the GI Bill, my mother went to college on the GI Bill, and, you know, it provided living expenses as well as paying for your tuition. It wasn't based on loans.
So are we talking about then Ozzie and Harriet? Are we talking about the man in the gray flannel suit? Are we talking about the ability to go out and make something of yourself and advance your place in the world? Was that the 1950s?
Well, I think there's something of both to that. You know, we forget now that it was pretty common in the 1950s for companies to have something called marriage bars. These were policies that meant that as soon as a woman got married, they had to quit because jobs were supposed to be reserved for men who were, you know, supporting families. So, you know, and for minorities, times weren't so great for them either. Back to women, if you were in a job where you were working when you were married, like, say, school teachers, if you got pregnant, that was it. As soon as you started to show, you had to quit. And the idea was you went home with your family and took care of them. But on the economic side, things were getting better really pretty quickly. You know, consumer sentiments were strong, purchasing was good, new products were coming out. And through about 1972, things were going just fine.
So let's compare 1955 with 2015. Obviously, more opportunities now for women, more opportunities for people of color. And yet it seems different. It seems like all of us have to struggle a little harder to do better than our parents. And even then, maybe it's not going to happen.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. In the 1960s, which was really the boom period for the U.S. in modern times, real wages doubled over the 1960s. And from about 1973 on, for about 15 years after that, real wages, particularly for lower level people like high school graduates only, fell by about one third. So it was a heck of a roller coaster after about 1973. Before then, you could just be sitting in the same job, and at the end of the decade, effectively, your wages were doubling. So your ability to go someplace economically and socially was pretty terrific. After about 1973, that started to collapse. And one of the consequences, back to Ozzie and Harriet, is it now took both Ozzie and Harriet working to try to maintain the same standard of living that they had just when Ozzie was doing it by himself.
And these days, you might have to get the kids involved, too.
Yeah, particularly if you live in those parts of the country where things are pretty expensive, like parts of California or New York City.
Another interesting comparison from back then to now is if you were in the middle class in the 50s, chances are you are on an upward trajectory. Whereas now, if you're in the middle class, you're struggling to keep your head above water in many cases.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think particularly if you were in the lower half of the economy, you know, we forget now that tax rates were pretty dramatically progressive. The top tax rates in the 1960s and through the early 70s were about 65% or so. That's the top marginal tax rates. But if you were at the lower end of the spectrum, the minimum wage value of the minimum wage was much higher in real terms than it is now. Unionization was quite prevalent. About a third of the workforce at its peak was unionized. And the ones that weren't, the employers were trying to keep pace with the unions to keep their employees from joining unions. So if you were a production or an hourly worker, things were pretty good for you. If you were at the top of the food chain, an executive, compared to today, things were not so great, largely because of taxes.
Where do you see the opportunities in today's society?
You know, one thing which is really different now is that you're rarely ever really stuck. You know, you're not in a company where, you know, you're not going anywhere, the immediate boss doesn't like you, and you're just stuck until you get the gold watch, which was the case, you know, a generation or so ago. You can pretty much always move now, and if you've got any kind of good skills, you could go someplace else. I think another thing which is much, much easier to do now is start a business, particularly a business that might involve technology or pretty high level of skills. It was quite difficult to do that a generation or so ago. It was difficult to get the money. It was difficult to get employees. All the good ones were locked up in lifetime employment with their own companies. And it's pretty easy to do that now, which is something we sort of take for granted. So on those sides, things are inarguably better. I think on the workplace side, that's where things have gotten tricky. Hours of work have gone up a lot. Real wages for most people have gone pretty flat over the last 25 years or so. So in the workplace, things are not so great unless you're at the top where things have gotten really good.
Well, and here's the thing to remember as well. When we go back to Ozzie and Harriet, nobody knows what Ozzie Nelson did for a living on that TV show. Peter Capelli is a professor of management at the Wharton School. Peter, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, we've talked about the good old days. Let's talk about potential opportunities in the future. And to do that, we're going to step into our time machine with Lori Shreve Blake. She's Senior Director of Alumni and Student Career Services at the University of Southern California. Lori, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, David.
And if I've got this right, you actually get paid to predict what the workplace of the future is going to look like, what industry of the future is going to look like.
Yes, I get paid to do that and also to prepare our students and alumni for those future industries and jobs.
Well, that is so flying cars and hoverboards, right?
Yes.
Okay, done. Roll credits. So let's talk about the future, because it's kind of hard when we're still kind of getting our legs under us after the recession to see more than a few weeks in advance. And here you are prognosticating years out. So my gut tells me that we're going to be even more high tech than we are now. But beyond that, I have no idea.
Yes. And our U.S. Department of Labor, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, also researches this and looks at kind of where the jobs are and what the demand will be for. And in terms of job majors for college students, we know that math will be a major that will be in demand because we have big data and we'll need people to analyze all that data and have those great analytical skills. We know that robotics is big. I did some research recently, and in the future, people who need to stay at home and don't necessarily want to go to a skilled nursing facility will be able to stay at home, seniors or people that are disabled, and a robot will assist them in getting their daily chores done and assist them with being able to stay home longer and living that independent life. So robotics is going to play a big part, not just for that senior citizen, but also in the car business, in transportation, in national security. Also, hospitality management is a hot area that people should look at, because even though we're virtual and we love to text and email and we're in this kind of virtual society, and we know in the future it's going to be even more the case, still people will want to get together and have community and break bread together. And so the hospitality management and the restaurant business, people who know how to manage that effectively in the future will still want to get together and break bread. That's good news.
But why will we anticipate there's going to be jobs for all these positions when we all know that artificial intelligence and Skynet and the Matrix are all going to come around and we will become drones to the master computer?
Yes. Well, I still think we're going to stay human. I don't think we're not going to be human. And so that whole piece of the restaurant piece, I think, is really a social piece and also connecting with people.
But it sounds like you're describing, at least from a workforce point of view, a nation of nerds. What if I'm somebody who wants to work with my hands? What happens to our manufacturing sector? What happens to a lot of components of the service sector?
Yes, yes. Well, I think the robots and the humans, what they're predicting, and the Bureau of Labor Statistics, actually PricewaterhouseCooper, has done a full report out of their London office about what work will look like in 2022. And even though there will be more robots in the manufacturing world and in other parts of our workplace, we will work together. We know that one thing that's going to happen is that people will go to more of a project-based work. And there's actually a job title that's going to be in demand called a business colony manager. And this is somebody who's going to help people kind of manage their careers and help them, guide them to these project-based jobs. Because we know now people will have 7 or 8 jobs before they retire. But in the future, it's going to be a lot of project-based work. So the Ubers of the world, they're in the car business, but they don't own any cars. So they have other people working for them. Those are projects, if you will.
Yeah, see, I don't know. You're describing a sort of golden age here. And as you say, humans and robots working together. And I can't help but feel that you were sent back from the future to soften us all up for what we all know is going to be robot Armageddon.
This is all research. Of course, you know, at the end of the day, we have to live through life and see what actually happens. But in looking at the data and looking at a lot of experts in the field, this is information that I uncovered. Also, liberal arts majors will still be in demand.
So yeah, what, the poetry degrees, things like
well,
that?
Well, you know what? Liberal arts still teaches students how to read, how to write, and how to speak. And those are valuable skills in business. And so there will still be a demand for that. We know that the top universities in the country, the top 25, liberal arts is the major that most of the students have.
All right, so to sum up, the opportunities here: people who know how to code, people who know how to build robots, mm-hmm. people who know how to work with robots, mm-hmm. people who aren't afraid of Arnold Schwarzenegger coming back and killing their mother. Yes?
Yes, but not just the technical side. As I said, the liberal arts people, the people who can kind of make that connection between technology and the real world. So it's not all tech, but work is evolving, and we have to evolve with it as professionals. And at the end of the day, what I tell all of USC students and alumni is that won't take away from knowing people and making connections with people. I think at the end of the day, that's still where the opportunity lies.
Lori Shreve-Blake is Senior Director of Alumni and Student Career Services at USC, and really quite the optimist, I must say. Lori, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, David.
Visit any major college campus these days and you'll probably see, well, a lot of international students, many of them from just one country, China. Attending college in America can open up a world of opportunities for them later in life. And with hundreds of thousands of Chinese students currently studying in the country, it's been a boom for colleges as well. But their admission is not without controversy. Here to talk about it is Matt Schiavenza. He's a contributor to The Atlantic. Welcome to Marketplace Weekend.
Hi, great to be on.
The number of Chinese students is growing exponentially. From the Chinese side, why is that?
Well, I mean, for one thing, you do have a much larger number of Chinese families who are able to afford the cost of American university tuition. And there is still a great deal of prestige from having a U.S. education, particularly a college education, but now even high school as well. So that combination means that far more parents of college-age students want to send their children overseas and have the money to pay for it.
Big factor there is they want them to come over and not just become fluent in English, but proficient in the culture.
Yeah, that is a part of it. I mean, what they want is to have their children gain what the Chinese call guanqi, which are connections with other elites who are also studying in the U.S., and to be able to have kind of an international cachet, and that makes them very attractive in the job market back in China, or in the U.S. if they choose to stay.
And they're very attractive to the U.S. universities as well. They're not paying those lower in-state tuitions. What are they paying?
Well, in many cases, especially at public universities such as Michigan State University, they pay full tuition, and nearly all of them do so. Some of them do obtain scholarships, but for the most part, they're there to pay the full amount of money, and that's a hugely attractive proposition for universities, especially public ones that often struggle to obtain funding.
Well, I know at the University of California, it's become a very big deal that some of the campuses seem to be courting not just out-of-state, but out-of-country students because they're so lucrative, and these students are taking places from local students who otherwise might have been able to go to the campus.
Yeah, it's caused some controversy on both ends, actually. It's worth pointing out. There have been cases where American or Californian students have complained that they were shut out of university because of so many international students were there. But several of the international students, in particular at Purdue University in Indiana, have complained that they're not there because they deserve to be there in their minds, but because the university sees them as a financially lucrative source of revenue.
Is that a valid criticism?
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, Purdue University in particular was controversial because they created a very expensive fee on top of tuition for international students.
Well, there's another element to this, too, and that is there's been some allegations that some of these students, if not many of these students, are fudging their applications and fudging their test scores to get into American universities.
Yeah, that is a very widespread practice. In China, it's worth pointing out that in order to get into a university, you essentially just have to take one major exam called the Gaokao. But in the U.S., as we know, getting into college requires letters of recommendation, extracurriculars, personal statements, and a whole lot else that simply doesn't apply in China. And this can be a very confusing process for Chinese high school students who often don't have the requisite English ability to master this. And so it's created a cottage industry in the country where people will help them massage their resume, help them write personal statements, help them with all these other processes simply to get them in. And, you know, in many cases, they arrive at these colleges and they're not quite as well prepared as they could have been.
Well, it's worth pointing out that U.S. students also enjoy a cottage industry of people who help them with tests, help them with essays and things like that. But I've spoken with some American college professors and university officials who say some of these students, particularly the ones from China, come and they just don't even speak the language, which throws up a lot of challenges.
Absolutely. And one thing is that in China, the way the education system works, and having taught English there myself, I have personal experience with this. They learn English in a very abstract way and as a field, like a science, and they often don't get a lot of opportunities to speak it and to learn how to use it in a daily way. And so they may be able to pass a test in English, but they don't really have that ability to sit in a lecture and listen to very complex subjects in the language and interact with a professor. So there is certainly that's a huge challenge for many of them.
All right. Matt Schiavenza is a contributing writer for The Atlantic. Matt, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And that's our show for this week. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Jenny Ament, Eliza Mills, and Austin Cross. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Jeff Peters is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm David Lazarus. Until next time, I'll see you in the business section. This is APM.